session number 11114, Real Free.
Colonel Chitty, Real Three. I think you were saying that you had...
Was this at the School of Instruction, they had a very good instrument maker. I was a corporal who looked after all the equipment, and he mended all the telephones and that. And he picked up, at the time, a cat's whisker was about the only thing he could do. And he made a small receiving arrangement with this, which he gave to me, which I had with me up just before I went back to the regiment when we were on Mount Carmel. And I put this thing up to listen, and I used to get the time signals on it. That's the first bit of wireless I had anything had anything to do with. And we didn't play with it anymore. I mean, there was nothing else you could do with. But it was interesting how things were beginning to...
Did they have a wireless at GHQ in Cairo?
Oh, I expect so. I don't know who... I mean, that was, I didn't know much about the real signalers, who were sappers, who were signalers. And I was basically regimental, who had a smattering of how to deal with the more elementary bits of signalling.
What did you do in Egypt when you were off duty?
Well, for quite a time, but while I was at the School of Instruction, I had a small pony, and we used to play polo down in Casera in the afternoons occasionally. And I did spend quite a lot of time with a local friend of mine in Cairo, recommended Munchi to teach me Arabic, and I spent quite... He used to come up for an hour or two, perhaps twice or three times a week, and to get on teaching me. He owned a small boys' school of 3 and 4 year olds up to that high in Cairo. And he didn't know a word of English, but he started to teach me like he'd teach the children. Result was, at least I got a pretty good accent. And by the time we'd finished in Cairo, I could usually explain what I wanted, if necessary, in fairly powerful terms. But and also, during that time, there was an old lady, a very curious, intelligent old lady, who was a friend of my parents. And her husband had died, and she, with two daughters, had retired to Helouan, just outside Cairo. And she was a very high-level Arabic scholar, in the proper Quran stuff and all that. And she's the only woman I've ever heard of who was actually was asked by the local people to preach a sermon in their mosque, which she did. Mm-hmm. So that way. But
what was Cairo like as a city to live in?
Well, I don't know now. I think it's awful. You know, but luckily, I didn't actually live here. We were 4 miles out, which was Montreal could read it. You know, I told you had a trab that went out, Sabre to Heliopolis. What I wanted, I had this friend of mine who was in the, I forget what his job was, he was fairly high up in the government, and he lived with he and his wife on Gazera Island. And I said, well, I could go out there in the spare afternoon to that, to have a change. And that was.
Were you able to get mail from home regularly? Were you able to keep in touch?
Yes, I think yes, one could do that. One thing that was curiously noticeable in Cairo, and when I was there, I wanted money because all of our pay was paid straight at Cox's, and I soon discovered that if you tried to cash a Cox's check in Cairo, you were thrown out on the street. There were so many temporary officers in there who checks bounced, and it was no good. I mean, nobody would take a Cox's check. Luckily, my bank was National Provincial, in which I had a modest balance at home, and I cashed in all the money I wanted on that without any comment. The club usually was the place where they would cash it, but the banks would too. That was one of the ways you managed to get on.
Did you notice any signs of nationalist feeling amongst the Egyptian population?
Not in those days, no.
Could you tell me about your training when you were with the Flying Corps? What sort of basic training they gave you?
Oh, everything. You went through engines, generally, which are always quite keen. I had a motorbike and used to keep up, and I liked playing about with engines. And then you had to learn about, the technical question of flying, so far as you could explain it on the ground, you had to get hold of. And one of the ones that luckily came fairly easy, you had to pass a Morse test. Now, I'd done in my school, with the school, with the Army side, had a standard of the minimum standard was 8 words a minute, and a word in the technical sense of the telephone say is a 5-letter group, not necessarily words but of any 5 letters or numerals. And when we got to the Air Force, you had to test your Morse up to 20 words a minute, which was pretty fast going. I passed the test because I'd done so much Morse, but that was much harder because they didn't. Every group was a full-sized group. You hadn't got any let up with shorter words.
What sort of aircraft were they flying from
here? Avros. The Avro was a two-seater. It was open to draft and I think pretty well foolproof. Unless you did anything very silly. I had been up before I went to Heliopolis. I'd been up with a friend there, and he spent a lot of time trying to get the seal on its back and failing to. You just wouldn't do that, but you could do most of the ordinary flying. And
were the conditions good for flying in Egypt?
Yes, on the whole, they are very good. Unless you got a crab seal, which was the hurricane winds over the desert. I mean, I had been in Cairo in May when you couldn't see the sun at midday. The desert was being blown in with a westerly wind, covered the whole place.
What were the aircraft being used for mainly? Were they mainly for reconnaissance?
I think so. I'm not sure what they were, because I think there was some with the Navy. When we were in Gallipoli, I know a friend of ours used to go and drop a bomb on Constantinople. But they weren't. I don't know what that machine was, but the average. I mean, there wasn't any really much military use for them at the time.
When you were on the peninsula, did you ever see any Turkish aircraft?
No. No, I don't think we ever saw anything up in it.
No balloons either, or anything like that?
No.
How did you get back to England then, after you were demobbed?
Well, I was in demobbed, and in those days they sent us down to the canal. Where I it was in the middle of the summer, and we were in a camp, and we used to go and bathe. You had to water the jetty from which you before you could tread on it, because it was so hot. And I was rather careless, so I got a good deal of sunburn on my back, which was very terrible, very painful. And then I was there only for 3 or 4 days, and they took us across to the Marseilles and dumped us there, and with a whole lot of troops. I found myself, I think, a senior officer on the boat. Well, we had several criminals with us. Military criminals, and in the cab ourselves, they were in a sort of enclave, not very tight of wire. And this chap had gone off, leaving it more or less me in charge of the cab. And in the morning, evening, I think, the sergeant came along and said, "Sir, the prisoners have all escaped." No, I didn't think very much we could do about that. However, in the morning he came in, he said, "It's all right, so they've all come back again." and then we were all herded into cattle trucks and brought back via Calais.
What, were they serious military criminals? What sort of things did they do?
No, I don't know what they were, what they'd done. They were not serious, I don't think.
Do you know why they'd broken out of the cage?
They wanted to have a good evening in Cairo. They didn't last sales.
So just recreational
escape? Yes, they were just out to enjoy themselves. Yeah, I think they weren't going to miss coming back to England.
Yeah. Did you carry on with your TA when you got back to England?
No. Not directly. I didn't resign, instead of going back to Cambridge, where I could have done my degree for 4 more terms or something, I say. For each year they gave you a free term, and the point after I'd been doing all these things, taking back to classics. And I was going out to a firm, my father knew people in India who ran business in Bombay, Karachi, Calcutta, and Madras. And the people who ran it were very, very closely allied with all the Wallace brothers who owned the Burma teak plantations. And they wanted people, normally they expected anybody to have either a first class degree or a blue or possibly both. Rather a slobs party, I say, in that way. But after the war, they took one from a family without any question of that sort. I went out to Madras where we were dealing with all sorts of exports, mainly groundnuts, but also cotton. We had cotton gins and presses down in South India, and we used to South Indian cotton is much better than any other Indian cotton. We used to export it to Japan. The groundnuts were really rather a menace because you had awful competition with firms like Raleigh and Volcott and that. And it was very difficult to make any money, which we didn't do that. But the other things, and on the other side, we'd imported peace goods, all sorts of cotton goods from Manchester. And that lasted for about 10 years, and then I decided that it wasn't very making very much progress with that. So I gave up and came home.
And do you think that you learned any really important lessons from your service in the First World War?
From the war?
Yes. Looking back on it.
I just... It was difficult to remember if I did. No, I think... except a general idea of discipline. And it gave me this that while I was in India, I joined up with what was known as the Auxiliary Force, India, which was the equivalent out there of territorials, and we had a very good battalion in Madras. The officers were European, but the NCOs and the troops were all Anglo-Indian, not Indian, Chiti. We had our own rifle range down on the beach by Madras, and we were very good rifle shots. We usually used to win the competition with any of the regiments, and that kept up sort of the general feeling. But well, it still is until I came home. Then I had to resign, and was on the officers' emergency reserve, and for the last war was called up because then I was working with the Iraq Petroleum Company as an assistant secretary in the London office. And of course our business there was getting the oil to the Mediterranean, and there was no question of it coming any further. And the London end, the business more or less packed up, and they said, all right, you go away. If you've got a job, go and do it. And I was called up to the Ministry of Supply, War Office branch, which was concerned with providing wheeled vehicles for all the services.
Was this a question of activating shadow factories and...
No, we didn't have to do that. We took hold of all the people like Ford and Vauxhall and Humber and those, and they'd built us. And we said, now then, you will do what we tell you. And we selected my colonel or brigadier at the time. He'd been in the ASC in the First War, so he knew about transport pretty well. And we just used to go to the Army and later to the Navy, the Air Force, who said, what do you want? And anything, and in this country we could build anything up to 3 tonners, which we couldn't do anything heavier than that. And we got their request, and then we more or less placed the orders out with the other people according to what, whether they were cars or 1500 weights or what you will. And by and large, we kept services supplied with what they wanted. By little bullying, you could rely on. You knew who you could rely on. Now Ford were the best because you could reckon within 5% of what you ordered they delivered. When you got out people like Humber, you were lucky if you could get half of it. you could piece that out and there were certain lorry makers who. And that went on through the war.
What was your role within the organisation? Were you liaising directly?
I was in a way, as a sort of a clerk to my CEO, say, Edgerton, collecting all the requirements, seeing that they were properly sent out, if necessary, visiting the makers, and that. Only one break I had was, I think it was in the winter of 41 or 42, where we were short, we couldn't make $6, and we wanted them badly for the African campaigns, and so a branch of our several of our officers were sent over to America. I had to chase the Pentagon to try and get $6. The other people wanted other sorts of weapons and that. And I had about 3 weeks at Christmas in Washington when the Potomac was frozen over. And you walked about very dangerously. You weren't careful, you sat down whenever you wanted to walk.
How did you find the American manufacturers compared to the British?
Well, we didn't really deal with the manufacturers. We had to get, only we dealt as far as the Pentagon, who on their side were dealing with the manufacturers, as we were in England. But they knew pretty well. I mean, they did things on a much bigger scale, and I think we got a certain amount of stuff out on them. We wanted.
In England, did you have liaison officers with all the manufacturers, or did you rely on visiting them? In England, did you have liaison officers with the manufacturers, or did you rely on going to visit them?
No, we had our own. There were other officers in our department who were, some of them were motor dealers and that, who they used to go out and could speak the language much more.
How was the price set for motor vehicles?
I don't think we worried. I mean, you took... there wasn't much use in arguing price. I think our people went into it, the ones who knew about it enough that we weren't particularly swindled. We got the machines. The worst time where we really had was after Dunkirk, because of Dunkirk we lost 40,000 vehicles, which was all that the army had in those days. And it shows how much the firms did buckle to at the time. We made all that up in 4 months.
Were you concerned at all with the allocation of resources like labour and raw materials to the firms?
No, they knew what they wanted. They got direct. I don't think that came into our line at all.
Where were you based? Where was the staff located?
London. I was in London the whole of the war, except for this voyage to America. London. It was the Adelphi to start with, the offices in there, and then we finally ended up in the railway offices at Euston. We had the top two floors, I think, of the.
Who was actually in overall charge of your section then? Did it come under the Quartermaster General's department? Or?
I think they were, no, because the whole department was drafted over to the Ministry of Supply, and if anybody was at the top, was Beaverbrook.
Did you see much of him?
No, I didn't do it. No, I kept. No.